Well, good evening. Thank you for being here. We welcome our visitors and we continue our study of Proverbs. We are in the section of our study where we're looking at topics in Proverbs and the different statements in this book that address that topic. So we're very happy to be together. Earl, would you lead us in a prayer?
Jehovah God, our Father in heaven, we praise you and we express to you now our gratitude for the written word. And we are here at this place tonight to open it and to study from it and glean from it truths, principles, precepts that will help us in our walk with you. And we will tonight be studying discipline and self-control. And we pray, Father, that you would help us to have discipline and self-control in our lives. Give us the strength that we do not possess in and of ourselves. We must come to you for strength and for help, and we pray that you would bless us and help us through the things that are a struggle to us, the things that are weaknesses and temptations to us. Help us, Father, to have the discipline and the self-control to live lives that honor you. Be with Philip as he teaches the class tonight, be with all of us, and help us to benefit from the time we spend together here tonight. In Jesus' name.
So, like a lot of topics that we encounter in Proverbs, this is a very generic one, has a broad application. And so the idea of discipline, self-control is not just a topic constrained to biblical teaching. In general, what do people think of, not their practice, but what do people think of discipline and self-control? How is it generally viewed by people? Negative or positive? That if you have these things?
I'd say generally positive.
Yeah. So in what areas of life do people think it's a good idea to be a disciplined person and one who has self-control? What kind of areas of living?
Don't behave in criminal activity.
Okay, that's right. Don't break walls.
Don't break walls.
Okay, because a lot of walls have to do with that. Yes, they do.
Finances?
Money? I mean, wow, just peruse media and look how much financial advice that you encounter. And a lot of it's related to that. What else?
Athletics
and fitness in general. Okay. What else?
Anger management.
I'm sorry.
Anger management.
Okay, your anger. Okay, we have a class later on about anger, but we are going to talk a little bit about anger even tonight. But, you know, managing your anger, your temper.
Shopping.
Yeah, shopping. Which falls into money, but also shopping. Yeah, don't, you know, go overboard when you're shopping. And what else?
School and children.
Okay. The children being behaved and cooperating and things such as that. And academics. Is another area where people think that, you know, discipline and self-control is a positive, is a good thing, okay? How do you get it in those areas? And this is what we've done a couple times, sort of circle around it and then zone in on what the Proverbs say. How do people generally think that you get discipline and self-control? Born with it?
Practice.
I mean, some people may think you're born that way. You know, I just can't seem to ever get my house picked up, or I can't seem to ever, you know, control my eating or whatever somebody may say. That's just the way I am. While so-and-so over here, you know, they don't have a problem with that. So some people may perceive it as a sort of an innate ability, at least in certain areas. So practice it. What else? How do you get it?
Commitment.
Yeah, there's a commitment. So let's get into this question. It is something that generally is seen as a positive. And what are the motives that people have as to why you should be disciplined and have self-control? What are the motives behind it? What are you trying to accomplish by being that kind of person? What outcomes are you looking for? And you can think back on some of those topics we thought of a while ago.
Well, an athlete wants to perform.
Sure.
When they're in a game or something, so they've got to have this.
Okay. There's some personal goal, and you can look at an athlete who wants to excel at a high level or win a game or the team win a game, and also somebody in their money, they're trying to accomplish, you know, the building of wealth, or getting fit and having a really fit body and being the envy of everybody else, that kind of thing.
Just in general terms, success in whatever endeavor we're
success
involved.
Yeah. Right. And it doesn't have to be. It's a very good term. And even there's some proverbs that you could say would fall in the category of this is a successful life kind of thing. But there is a lot of self-interest and discipline and self-control. And this is where we part ways with the general subject of discipline and self-control and what the Bible and even the Proverbs specifically reveal about it. And that is, why do we develop self-control? Is it just so that we can accomplish some personal goal, just to stand out, just to acquire more physical things, just to have a greater physical body or something like that? Well, as we've seen, the Proverbs are teaching us wisdom. But this wisdom has a goal. Why are the Proverbs teaching us to be wise, and why are the Proverbs teaching us to choose a wise path? Ultimately, why? Where does it start and end?
Fear.
What?
Fear of the Lord.
God. Fear of the Lord. Wisdom comes from God, and to make it to God, you have to develop some wisdom. And we started off in this class talking about how that, in essence, godliness and wisdom are equivalent. Wisdom is not just, you know, having a savvy approach to life, but wisdom in the biblical sense, and especially the proverbial sense, wisdom is a God-towardness. It is living not just a smart, good life, but a smart, good life the way God wants us to, for His sake, for God's sake. That's one of those expressions that people throw out, for God's sake, geez, very flippantly. But getting away from the flippant use of it, when you think about the real message of that idea, it's exactly why we're to be wise, for God's sake. We're trying to please Him, be like Him, be close to Him, and all those kinds of things. So, and when you think about Christ's example, Christ's example of self-control and discipline, and that almost boggles our mind to think of what He had to go through. But that shows us that there's a place for this. Now, you know, there's a balance here. I think we mentioned sometime Sunday, I think, about the idea of a monastic life, and that is not in harmony with being a Christian. It's getting off to yourself, separating yourself from everyone around you. That is not, you know, biblical Christianity. And one aspect of monasticism was the idea of you discipline yourself. You deny yourself a lot of physical things and so forth. You know, you have to get up at midnight every night and pray. You go to bed like at 9, but you gotta get up at midnight. I'm serious. One of the orders does that. And then you get to go back to bed, but you gotta be back up at 6. And it's just that on purpose, just to force you to make yourself do that. That is not godliness, the idea of just purely physical denial. But there is an aspect that we cannot be godly people without some self-control. A lot of self-control. Yeah, Becky.
I was just thinking that Daniel is an amazing example of that. That we see every day he had this discipline to set himself up and follow God and pray at a certain time of day, to where people knew that this is what he was going to do.
Yeah, and it's not just a prayer incident in that book, but several of the things in Daniel's life had to do with self-control and self-discipline, as well as his three friends. So he's a good example of that. And he's really a good example of that, of how his self-control was related to his godliness. So let's talk about this in light of what the Proverbs teach. So we're going to talk, first of all, about the subject of discipline. Okay. Now, there's really two kinds of discipline that we can talk about that are even presented in the Proverbs. So internal discipline is basically the same thing as self-control. That you discipline yourself. That you restrain yourself, you guide yourself, you have parameters for yourself, etc. So we'll talk about that second, okay? There's also the external dimension of discipline. That you are being taught discipline, not from the, you're not applying discipline from the inside out, but you're being disciplined from the outside in. Now, we have a class later on about child rearing, and we're going to talk about discipline. And the actual discipline of children. But the Proverbs also talk about discipline, not as you discipline children, but as a person that you embrace discipline. In other words, things are happening to you and you learn the right lesson. And actually, they go together. It's the person who is trained oftentimes by external forces to be disciplined that later in life learns discipline from within. It's all about control. If children aren't controlled, then they don't learn control. Sort of the point. So file that in the back of your head when we get back to children later on. So let's talk about, in the Proverbs, the external dimension part. And I think it would be apparent when you look at this. Look in Proverbs 12, verse 1, first of all. Proverbs 12, verse 1. Tristan, can you read that for us, please? 12:1.
Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid.
Okay. What translation do you use?
New King James.
Okay, I thought it was the 8th grade translation. But that's, yeah, it does have that in some places. Very good. I like that. This is where the idea of external discipline is going to overlap with a principle that we've seen several times. Okay? In Proverbs 12:1, understanding Hebrew parallelism, what is synonymous to discipline?
Reproof.
And reproof is what someone tells you to correct you. And so the parallel statements have to do with discipline and reproof. They are disciplining you. They're helping you to learn control. It's an outside force doing this. And it comes in the form of a verbal rebuke or reproof. Now, the Hebrew term discipline here, and translated in the English Standard and several other translations as discipline, has with it the connotation of instructive discipline. It's not punishment. Punishment can be instructive, but sometimes we think of punishment, we just think of punishment as just some inflicted punishment. But discipline carries with it the idea in this Hebrew term, and sometimes in our English words that we use, the idea of instructive discipline, that you're learning a lesson in this. It's not just pain, discomfort. It's not just a negative experience for the sake of a negative experience, but you're trying to learn through this. So once again, one of the key attitudes for developing wisdom is being able to listen. No one ever became wise who wouldn't listen. And when somebody says to you, "You're not listening to me here. You never listen to me. You've not been listening to me." It could be a parent telling someone that. It could be a spouse. It could be a friend. It could be an employer. That is like a gigantic red flag. Now, they could be misapplying it. They could be incorrect. But you got to make sure that they're not incorrect. Because this is a real, real pitfall, not listening. So let's look at a couple of passages about listening and look at it in light of the idea of discipline. Look at 19:20, Proverbs 19, verse 20. Elaine, can you read that verse, please? 19, verse 20.
Listen to counsel and accept discipline, that you may be wise the rest of your days.
Okay, very good. My translation, English Standard, says listen to advice. Yours says listen to counsel. Mine says accept instruction. Yours says accept discipline. See how that's phrased there? Is it New King James or New American?
New American.
New American, okay. Listen, accept, and that's how you gain wisdom. Look at 23:12. Zachary, can you read 23, verse 12?
Apply your heart to instruction and your ear to words of knowledge.
Okay. Apply your heart. This is another way of saying listening. Apply your heart to wisdom and your ear to words of knowledge. It's another way of saying listening or heeding. Applying your heart. Applying your ear to words of instruction. It's just another way of saying it, but it's a very effective way of saying it. That you're actually engaging your heart, your inner person. You're actually making a focused attempt to listen to someone in this. Okay? And you see what this is teaching, and that is, this is absolutely crucial to find the path to wisdom. So you see something about wisdom there? Wisdom is not something you necessarily conjure from within yourself. You can contemplate things, you can reflect on things, you can observe things, and you can generate wise thoughts. But wisdom ultimately comes from God. And often comes through other people. And you're not going to gain that wisdom unless you listen. So let's keep looking at these. Coming back to the idea of more specifically of discipline. Ken, can you read chapter 6, verse 23, Proverbs 6 and verse 23? This is going back to those early chapters about wisdom. What does it say there? It's a good statement.
For the commandment is a light and the teaching, for the commandment is a lamp. And the teaching of life, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life.
Thank you. Another Hebrew parallelism. It's basically building on the same statement. The second one is. They're similar statements, but the second one is enhanced. The first one's about commandments being an illumination to our path, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life. Oftentimes, for us to learn the lessons we need, it has to be a lesson through discipline, which involves some kind of correction, even pain and discomfort. It might just be emotionally. And it comes via a reproof. And it says that path, in that path, is the way of life. I don't think this is saying, that's just a way of life, okay? I don't think this is saying, that's just part of life. No. This is saying that if you want to find life, if you want the way of life, you've got to heed instruction and gain wisdom even by reproof. In other words, real life. This is not the only place in the Bible where some Bible writer or some speaker, and certainly Jesus says several things along this line, so it's Paul in his writings, that there is life, but then there's the real life. There's living, but there's real living. And real living involves discipline. I mean, that's, a lot of people would just, they just wouldn't think that's so. But real living involves self-control. I don't know if I completely understand all that, all those dimensions myself. Except to trust God that when I conform to what He wants me to do, inherent in that is real life. And anything short of that is a substitute for real living. So, all right, look at 3:11 and 12. Going back to those early statements about wisdom and the nature of it, but this is really good to plug in here. Lori, reread 3:11 and 12.
My son, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of His reproof. For the Lord reproves him whom He loves as a father, the son in whom He delights.
Where is the discipline coming from this time? If it's external, from whence is it coming?
God.
From the Lord, from God. Instead of a rebuke from somebody, it's from God. It may be a rebuke from God. But there are different ways that God may discipline us. Just the unfolding events in life. Sometimes the relationships with other people, He's disciplining us. Why does He do it, according to this text? It's love. It's actually reflective of what relationship?
Father-child.
Father-son. There's a very prominent place where this is quoted in the New Testament. Does anybody recall where that's at? It's in Hebrews 12. So in Hebrews 11, you've got the chapter about the famous people of faith. You know, Abel, Noah, Abraham, and so forth. And then chapter 12 talks about you're surrounded by these witnesses. So commit your way and throw off sin and go all the way and follow the author of our salvation, Christ. And then around verse 5, 6, and 7 in there, it's basically saying, and this is sort of the heart of the message of that book, the book was written to Jewish Christians who were going back on their faith, who were giving up faith in Christ, in part because they were suffering for it. In Paul, I'm sorry, not Paul, but the writer of Hebrews says there in chapter 12, you've not suffered until bloodshed. You've not shed your blood yet. And Christ was referenced earlier as this great example of suffering. And then he quotes this. What he's saying is, as a Christian, you may be going through difficult times. Don't give up your faith. It's actually God disciplining you because you're his children and he loves you. And so there's where you've got to absorb the discipline from the outside and let it have its work on you and change you. And then one more, 1532. This is interesting. I don't think I really thought about this one before. 1532. Wes, would you read that for us, please?
He who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds rebuke gets understanding.
All right. This goes pretty deep into the human psyche. And I looked at all the different translations, and they all, the modern, literal translations, English, Standard, New King James, New American, even King James, not so modern, speak of if you don't heed instruction, you despise your soul or you despise yourself. I think it's possible that someone is so filled with themselves, so prideful, so arrogant, they don't listen to anybody. That's true. It's also true that there are some people who think so little of themselves that they don't want to make themselves better. They don't think it's of any use. Proverbs are about providing guidance and counsel to find the path of wisdom so you can have the best, most productive, most fulfilling, most beneficial life for yourself and other people, and thus ultimately honor God. It is, Earl used the term success, and I said, that really applies to, in a certain way, to the book of Proverbs. True success in Proverbs is the wise life, and it is the most successful life. It has nothing to do with earning money, it has nothing to do with fame and fortune. And what this text is telling us, and this really goes deep into the heart and mind of the human heart and mind, the one who refuses to learn, the one who refuses to listen, the one who refuses to make adjustments and changes as their discipline, they have a very low view of themselves. That's true with some people. This person is not trying to live the best life they can live, because they have such a low view of themselves. They have a ruinous self-image, so their life is made up of ruinous choices, and in the end, their life is a ruin. It all stems to their identity. I heard somebody propose something today, this is something I ran into, and as a religious person, and I don't know. I feel like I'm standing on the edge of the ocean here trying to figure this out. That one of the great crises that people have in contemporary times is identity. whether it's sexual identity, communal identity, whatever. And I thought there was a lot of truth in that. You know, how do you see yourself? Who are you? Who are you? Do you find out who you are by looking inside of you and what you feel like doing and what your inclinations are? Or are you able to find your identity because you're a human being made in the image of God? And that inherently means you have unfathomable worth as a human being. More valuable than any animal, plant, object, anything. You're more valuable as one single human being than the sun. The sun in all its glory. The sun is not a human being. The sun does not have qualities that you have as a human being. So the person who won't listen, this really challenges our thinking about why people don't listen. Sometimes it is because of pride, but sometimes pride is only a front. This is saying that the person who won't listen to correction, who won't gain wisdom from being disciplined, they're not valuing what God values. They throw away their potential for really productive living. Because God makes us with all this worth and value, and all this, God makes us with all this incredible potential. But then we have to choose to fulfill it. We have to choose to follow it. We have to choose a wise path, as we've seen in this class over and over, to maximize this potential, this energy, these qualities God's put in a human being. Or we can choose a foolish path and we trash ourselves. I mean, think about the other day we were reading about the young man who falls for the temptress. And it says at the end of that chapter 7, he ends up in a trap, just like a bird in a trap. He ends up in a pit. And it's self-destruction. So that is a really interesting way to look at being disciplined and accepting discipline. Okay, we've looked at several of these. We're going to look at self-control now. If anybody have comments, this is a good juncture to see if you want to make an observation or add something or something. Yeah, listen.
I was thinking back to the two great commandments that Jesus spoke, you know, the Lord, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, which implies that you love yourself. You can't love your neighbor if you don't love yourself. And so much of what Jesus spoke, of course he said that what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? So that relates to the idea that you were saying, how that we are more valuable than the sun. And Jesus said, our soul is more valuable than the world. That's pretty valuable.
It's very valuable.
And, you know, I hate to be the one to bring this up, but evolution has, in many people's minds,
right,
made us equal to animals.
Yep.
So that we have lost our identity, by virtue of the family tree not being human, a human family tree, but a family tree that includes all life on earth, which makes us equal to every life on earth, including bacteria and viruses. We have no more value than they do, if evolution is true.
Yeah, the problem with the naturalist perspective and everything that spins off of that, like you just described, is not that the trees don't matter, and that squirrels don't matter, and that deer don't matter, and that bugs don't matter. No, they're incredible. They're incredible value, incredibly of great value. But we are so much more. That's the point. It's not that God's creation is not valuable. It is. It's that we are so much more valuable. And, you know, Jesus talks about that, the sparrows and things like that. I preached a sermon on that earlier this year, I think. But, yeah, I mean, it's in that first and second great commandment, look at the value system there. First commandment, second commandment, love God, love your neighbor as yourself. Who's valuable? God, first, then you're valuable and I'm valuable. I love you because you're valuable. You're valuable to God. And I'm valuable to God. And so there's a value system built in that, in those commandments, right? Yeah. Okay, go.
So I was just thinking about, I guess I'm a little younger than most people, so I'm a little closer to being disciplined by my parents a lot. So, and one of the things that always got me in trouble was my big mouth, and my mom and dad would always, whenever they disciplined us, they would always make sure to quote scriptures to tell us why we were being punished, and that kind of makes you feel a little bit worse. But one of the ones that always hit me really hard and always helped a lot was that Proverbs 17, verse 28, where it says, "Even a fool, when he holdeth his peace, is counted wise, and he that shutteth his lips is esteemed a man of understanding."
Right.
So.
Yeah. And I think Andrew's shown incredible restraint at not making comments about how you got in trouble. Okay. So let's talk about self-control. So this is that dimension from the inside out. You're disciplining yourself, okay? And I got three I want us to look at. These are wonderful to contemplate. 1911, again, we're talking about not somebody giving you reproof, not the Lord disciplining you, but rather you exercising self-control. 1911, Ray Conies, can you read that for us, please? 1911.
Good sense makes one slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook an offense.
All right, thank you. Now, we're going to study anger on a specific night later on, or class later on, that's in the 2-3 weeks. But, and I don't want to get too much into controlling anger, because we're going to talk about that separately. Just like the other day, we talked about male-female relationships and adultery and all that. So we're talking about sexual self-control. We're going to talk about money. We're going to talk about anger. We're going to talk about other aspects of control later on. So this is one of those pivotal kind of subjects. But I do want us to look at this because I think it's got an interesting aspect. What does, in the English Standard says this here, overlook an offense. What does that mean here? It's used positively. Does that mean that you just downplay somebody's wrongdoing, you wink at it, it's not important? What does it mean here to overlook an offense?
Reminds me, with childbearing, we sometimes say, pick your battles.
Okay.
You know, can overlook some things. Yeah. May not have dire consequences.
Okay.
Other things have greater consequences, okay, and you're going to want to address it.
Yeah, and this appears to be about personal relationships, slow to anger and overlooking an offense, that you're describing basically the same kind of reaction, that you're letting something go. And like with certain things a kid may do, you may let that go, like you say, pick your battle. So what do we mean here by letting things go that's an offense?
Well, like you're not getting, if you're slow to anger, then if you don't let something go, then you might get into a brawl.
Right.
So then your good sense means that you're letting it go and kind of foregoing whatever question to your honor or whatever.
Right. And does the text state that there is an offense? It does. There is an offense. And you may have a sort of a justified anger, an indignation about, you know, what is right and wrong. But you control that. What were you going to say, Neil? You had something?
American Standard goes through this as it is glory to pass over a transgression.
Sorry.
To be, so in other words, in some cases, to respond to a transgression, you have to lower yourself. This is suggesting that there's some things that you don't need to get down and get dirty with it. Mm-hmm. You just go, you're above that, and you need to stay above.
That's a good way of looking at it. How can you let an offense go? One way to look at it is, okay, if I respond to this, I may, and this is sort of related to what works, I may get pulled right down to doing something that's wrong myself. And it's easy to do that. How many times do you mistreat someone, but it's coming out of the idea that they mistreated you? And so you're right, you're getting down into a brawl in the street then. Yeah.
Oftentimes when it comes to being a parent, it's time to instruct the child. Go to the room, come to being for a little while. You are keeping yourself above anger, frustration. The negative is they need to be corrected, yes, but you've got to be in control before you correct.
Yeah, that is a practice of self-control. I mean, it's not that sin is to be winked at and anything like that, but when it comes to personal relationships, the wise person and the control person let some things go. They just let it go. And there might be, and going back to Lane's term about picking your battles, there might be a time when you've got to address what's happened. There's a necessity of that, and that's where wisdom and discernment comes in. Yeah.
If you've been truly wronged by someone, you kind of have earned the right to respond to it, but the attitude of grace and mercy, you give up your right, basically, to respond in anger to someone who has wronged you. I think it was in one of the Corinthian letters where some of the brethren were going to law, you know, about their issues, and he says, why didn't you just receive the wrong and let it go? You know, why take this to a civil court? Why don't you just receive the wrong?
Right.
Let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's there are passages that tell us, like Jesus talks about, you know, you got something, your brother's got something against you and all that. There's a place sometimes to addressing when you're wrong. But there's also a place for letting it go. And you got to be able to discern what's important there. That's it.
One proverb that's been a long half figure of mine that's closely related to this, I don't know if you're going to use it or not, is 12 verse 16.
Go ahead, you can use it. Go ahead, say it again.
I said Proverbs 12 verse 16 is, the vexation of a fool is known at once, the proof of being worse than insult.
Okay, there you go. It's a great parallel cross reference. It's a great, it's an insult, so it's a personal attack.
Yeah.
But they're letting it go. And then think about how much self-control that requires. That's why I brought it up in this. And then there's 23, 1 through 3. This is good. 23, 1 through 3. Andrew, read that for us, please. 23, 1 through 3.
When you sit down to eat with a ruler, consider carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat, if you are a man given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are to set the food.
All right, thank you. Now, what is the action? The setting is you're sitting at a king's table. Pretty good spread. What's the action that the wise man tells us to do? And it's imagery, it's a you know, poetic statement. What is it?
Put a knife to your throat.
Put a knife to your throat. What in the world's that? Well, in the Orient, and generally the Orient is both the Near East and the Far East. Today we talk about the Middle East. But basically the Orient is the East. Everything from the Near East, like Turkey all the way to China, and Japan, the Far East. In the Orient, this was even in ancient times, a fairly common expression. And what it meant was to check yourself, restrain yourself. So think about it. If somebody put a knife to your throat, you're not moving, right? You're not budging. If there's ever a time you don't move, it's when somebody's got a knife to your throat. I had to have eye injections one time, several of them. And they never strapped me down. They set me in there and they stuck a needle in my eye. And I couldn't move. They told me not to move. Yeah, I'm not going to move. You're sticking a needle in my eye. I don't want to run down the hall of the thing, you know, bobbing out of my head. I mean, it's the idea that you're not going to budge. Well, put a knife to your own throat. So this is the idea of self-restraint. We have an expression that means something different, but it's like it. In our culture, and that is bite your tongue. What does bite your tongue mean?
Hold back what you're going to say.
Do what? Hold back what you're going to say. You don't literally bite your tongue. I thought that would work. But bite your tongue means don't say something. So it's a similar kind of idea. Well, why is it that you restrain yourself? Well, in verse 3, what is the perspective of verse 3? This food you're looking at, what does it say at the very end of verse 3?
It's deceptive.
It's deceptive. It's not what you think it is. Okay? And so the whole demeanor here is be wise, look carefully at this, don't be deceived by the surface, and restrain yourself. Now, why? Okay? Two possibilities here. One is, this is actually a test by this king who's checking to see what kind of character you have. And if he lays out before you all this food, that you go at it like you're a hog, that doesn't reflect well on your character and your own kind of control about yourself. And so he's testing to see what kind of person you are. Another idea is that he's wooing you. Why does somebody put on a big showy feast? They're trying to show off their power. They're trying to intimidate. They're trying to coerce. They're trying to woo. And here is someone who's trying to dazzle you with their wealth and their resources. Don't be taken in by that. Keep your wits about you. Keep your senses. And if you've ever, and I haven't had very many of these, but we probably all have had something like this. When you go somewhere where you typically don't hang out, I mean, the furnishings are more expensive, the food's fancier. I mean, everything is just several class levels above you, and you're like, it can be intoxicating. You got to keep your wits about you. And that's the idea. Yeah.
Kind of interesting, too, that you have to be honest with yourself. There's a caveat under if you are a man given to appetite. So you have to know yourself.
Know yourself, yeah. Yeah, this is a weakness.
This is a weakness of mine, yeah. So I've got to be extra careful.
Yeah, put the knife to your throat wherever you have an appetite. That's a general principle here, isn't it? Yeah, interesting. And then there's this last one here. You got to put this one in here with this. In these texts here, 25 verse 28. Earl, can you read that for us? 25, 28.
Like a city that is broken in two and without walls, is a man who has no control over his spirit.
Okay. You don't have self-control. You're like a walled city with no walls. You're like a city without walls. Now, in ancient times, for the advent of the canon, the most secure cities were those with walls. That's why it's a big deal in the Old Testament. Like, they go back to Babylonian exile, and the Persians who rebuild Jerusalem, and they started to get the walls rebuilt because Jerusalem would never be secure without walls and all that kind of thing. The advent of canon took that away. But this is an incredible image, isn't it? Here is this city with all this treasure and resources, and has no security system. Can you imagine a bank without locks and security cameras and alarms? So basically, you're exposed if you don't have self-control. And so we're going to talk about money later on, and temper and speech. We've already talked about male-female relationships. If you don't have the ability to control yourself, you're exposing yourself, putting yourself in danger. Okay, out of time. Thank you very much for your comments and your interest. Thank you very much.